Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy. In this programme, we get our folk on through a new film by the Coen brothers, reflect on the life and music of Pete Seeger and the world of folk more generally, and catch up with genre-defying tunesmith Mary Epworth before she hides out to write her next album. Joining me as ever is the hammer that keeps on hammering, the man most likely to be next immortalised in statue form in the Guildhall Square, our very own man from the village, Dave Allen.
Does that mean my days are numbered, do you think?
It could be. We're going to start tonight with film, and we've got a bit of a folk theme running through this programme. We did mention in the last programme that we asked you to do some homework and go and seek out Dave Von Ronk, and we've got a film loosely based on a recent book of his from about 2005, I think. The film we're going to talk about is the Coen brothers' new film, which is called Inside Llewyn Davis. So, Dave, set the scene for us.
I think you're right. It is loosely based around the life history of Dave Van Ronk. Dave Van Ronk was a very prominent folk musician in New York City in particular in the early 60s. So the film takes place in about a week in the life of this, I guess in a sense, I've seen him described as world-weary, but he's a kind of loser folk singer, but a folk singer who he's not completely loser, he's an almost folk singer. You know, he almost makes it, he's almost good enough, but he just doesn't quite have that magic. And it takes place in January 1961, which is an absolutely key moment in the American folk revival, which has been underway for some little time. But in January 1961, Dave Van Ronk pretty much rules the roost in New York as a guitarist and singer in a loosely folk bluesy kind of style. He plays some ragtimey stuff, plays some classic old songs, House of the Rising Sun and Cocaine and so on. But in January 1961, a young man called Robert Zimmerman arrives in New York. And Robert Zimmerman is, of course, Bob Dylan. And just at the end of the film, you get this two verses of Bob Dylan doing one of his first gigs at this famous club in Greenwich Village called The Gaslight. And you kind of know that that's the moment where the famous issue between the two of them is that Dave Van Ronk arranges a version of House of the Rising Sun, which has been around for some 30, 40 years already. And lots of people have recorded it. Van Ronk arranges a very fine version of it, which Bob Dylan pretty much copies. And he goes to Van Ronk and says at some point, Dave, would you mind if I recorded, you know, this tune on my album? And Van Ronk says, well, I'd rather you waited a little while because it's about to be recorded for my first album. And Bob says, well, I'm very sorry, Dave, but actually I've already done it and the album's coming out. And it's the kind of new young folk punk replacing the kind of elder statesman. And
that's too ruthless for folk, isn't it? That kind of behaviour, I would have thought.
Well, I think that actually that's one of the questions that runs through this particular film, and indeed through folk music generally, which is to what extent is folk music a part of the showbiz entertainment industry, and to what extent must it necessarily be wedded to authenticity? And a challenge for this guy, Llewyn Davis, is that he's uncompromising about his music. He won't compromise it at all. He falls out with friends at a party who ask him to play over a dinner party, and he says, you know, I'm not a party piece, and storms out, causes a big fuss and so on, because in one sense he has this extraordinary integrity about his music, but it doesn't necessarily lead him to act with integrity outside the world of music, and he's a bit dodgy on occasions. And I think that's the tension. So at one point he goes to Chicago to do a kind of audition for a guy called Bill Grossman, which in itself is one of the witty little things that happens in the film. There are lots of references in the film which, if you pick them all up, just kind of make you smile. So Albert Grossman was the man who managed Peter, Paul and Mary and Bob Dylan and came from Chicago. So there's this fictional Bill Grossman in Chicago running a big folk venue, and he goes to audition for him and plays a very beautiful song, and Bill Grossman at the end of it simply says, I can't hear any money in that. He doesn't say I don't like the song or it's not, it just, I can't hear any money in it.
That's a particular
and
window.
There's that tension all the way through the film, really. Yeah.
So is that, you mentioned that this is really, I suppose, cataloguing a number of near misses for a kind of reasonably successful but not that successful artist. I suppose there's a question about, you know, is it a comedy of errors, or is it sort of Is it lampooning a folk scene, or is it celebrating the scene, or is it just questioning what on earth happened to some of those acts that we've never heard of? Or, you know, they were so wedded to what they were doing, so committed to that scene that they just couldn't commercial or couldn't get into the mainstream.
That's right. I mean, Dave Van Ronk that we're talking about is in a sense the most accomplished. You talked off air earlier about Americana, which was not a term of the time, but it's kind of Americana, it's kind of folk blues and so on. He was the most accomplished of those. You might argue that, you know, that the most virulent, the most strident, the most accomplished protest singer was a man called Phil Ochs, who was also, in a sense, Dylan's alter ego, and again didn't go down the commercial route and so on. And there is an argument to say that, you know, Bob Dylan, who had briefly played keyboards with Bobby V, you know, the heartthrob of American pop, that Bob Dylan was always about establishing himself as a pop star, but he just didn't want to be seen as a pop star he wanted to be seen as a man of integrity and a pop star simultaneously, and he did a fabulous job of it. I don't think it's a parody. I think it's a quite respectful record of a period in popular music which, frankly, like an awful lot of popular music of the time, gets dismantled within 2 years by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and so on and so on. One of the fundamental problems with that authentic folk scene was that it was so reverential. You know, there are two scenes, I think, in the film where people are sitting in the gaslight and somebody talks and everybody goes, shh, stop talking. You're not allowed to talk, there's a musician playing.
There is that key word you used, integrity. I think that there's a suggestion that, you know, a number of these artists who, you know, really, I suppose, circle around Washington Square in Greenwich Village, you know, kind of physically there busking on a Sunday afternoon, rather than earning their spurs in the clubs, they're out there physically kind of, you know, playing against each other in some ways. They're all committed to being serious, deep artists who have integrity, rather than at the expense of any kind of popularity. Or celebrity. One thing I wonder about the film, and I've been more sort of digging into the soundtrack than actually the actual cinema piece, but is it a live concert film? Does it feel more like a kind of live concert film than it does a kind of folk story, you know, a kind of a story of folklore, if you like?
Well, I there's a thing I wonder about it, which is if you took away 1961 Greenwich Village folk music and you told this story of this guy who's kind of world weary and a loser and, you know, got difficulties in his social community, you could reconstruct that story, you know, in a different way. I mean, just as the Coen brothers have previously taken you know, tales from Greek mythology and transplanted them to the American South or something, you could do it the other way around with this story. It doesn't have to be a folk story, but there's a rather quirky, nice tale, which is that the Coen brothers have said, and I don't know what made them even think of this, because they're a bit younger than me, and I'm not quite old enough to remember 1961 and folk scene. I am by 63-4, and of course, what's happening in 61 in New York is happening in 62 in London, and about 64 in Portsmouth. It takes that time to filter. So I do remember those early folk days, similar days, in Portsmouth folk clubs, and some of the songs on the soundtrack, you know, the Tom Paxton song and 500 Miles and things. I remember those. But there is this thing about how, it doesn't have to be about folk music. One thing I will say in response to your question is, I mean, they're not concerts because they're tiny places. They're like the places we went to in Portsmouth, you know, the back rooms and top rooms of pubs, slightly bigger than that, but the Gaslight is a basement, and I suppose it seats no more than about 50 or 60 people. And it's a coffee bar, so they're not drinking copiously. And there's an interesting question about how on earth anybody managed to make any money out of it, which I'm not sure they did make a lot. But when you get those performances shown in The Gaslight, and the whole film begins with one of those, with Llewyn Davis singing this particular song called Hang Me, Oh Hang Me, which is a traditional song that Van Ronk has previously done. It really, that does feel authentic, and there's one microphone and a tiny PA system, and the microphone is ambient. It's not for voice or guitar, it's for a bit of both. So you're like, I don't know, you're a yard away from it, and it's just picking up the ambient sound. That feels very real, all of that. That's what I remember it being like.
Now, like a lot of Coen brother films, there's a lot going on in the background, isn't there? I think in terms of, this to me strikes me as a film that's about a journey, you know, that Oh Brother, Why Art Thou is probably the comparator. You know, people say, oh, this is the new kind of one of those. And there is a comparison there, because it's about, and I'll use this word, it's about an odyssey, a journey, an adventure. There is this idea that this guy is moving from being down and out and down on his luck to the audition, and to fame, yes. And fame is the kind of holy yes. grail, but he can't get too near it because he's too true to himself. He's too kind of pure, you know, and because of his own sort of moral construct, yeah. he won't compromise and won't yeah. get to where he believes he should be. That's should right. be going.
There do seem to me to be questions like that that present themselves to any kind of musician. My story would be slightly different, but my story has been wrapped up to a very large extent, apart from the 1980s, I've through all the decades since the mid-60s, played around the folk scene in kind of folk blues outfits and still do. You know, I mean, I've got at least two folk festivals to play this year. My way of staying true to the music was to have another job. You know, so it didn't matter. But I don't want to say that wasn't in my case a decision about integrity, you know, staying true to the music. It was a decision that actually wasn't good enough to make it. And so, but I was good enough to work reasonably regularly on a semi-professional local scene. You know, you kind of work, it's a bit like being a footballer, you know, and you figure, I'm not going to make it with Manchester United, but having it at Waterlooville might pay me 50 quid a week, you know. And it's a bit like that. So I think, you know, the question for me in my mind, close to my experience, was would Llewyn Davis was about to go back to work as a merchant on the merchant ships. Would he make that same kind of decision? Would he decide that actually he's never going to make it? A, because perhaps he doesn't have that magic spark, and B, that scene, that genre, that world is no longer actually open to him. Mm. And within 2 or 3 years, Bob Dylan has kind of crushed it by going electric, you know. So I can't do it. So, but I could keep working and earn a reasonable income, semi-professionally, and so on. And be a merchant seaman. Is that where he's going? Or, you know, will there be an outside Llewyn Davis part two, in which suddenly in 1963 he discovers protest songs, you know, and becomes a big star?
It could be a great follow up, couldn't it?
It could. Yeah, yeah.
There's an expression, and it's called getting on the wrong bus. Okay, so yeah. you know, you kind of if you get on the wrong bus, yeah. you go on a journey, you learn lots of things. Yeah. But you're on the wrong bus. You get on the right one, you get where you want to go, yeah. and you know you get yeah. there quickly. That kind of thing. Yeah. There's a war going on in this film as well, I think. There's a war between kind of beatniks and folkies. People will assume, I think, that that's kind of the same bracket. You know, people will assume yes. that, you know, a folk artist, if you like, yes. is a beret-clad, bearded, yes. artistic gent yes. in a polo neck, thrashing the hell out of a guitar, singing about a horse or something, you know, like that. Again, I'm paraphrasing. Yes. But it strikes me, some of the things I've read and certainly through some of the music, there's a tension there, isn't there? There's the kind of, you've got beatniks, and we've spoken about them before on the programme, and you've got a folk scene that is kind of dropping between two emergent scenes.
I think that's a very interesting reading of it that I've not thought of or heard of before, but there is a kind of complication between what's called the world of the beats, you know, Burroughs, Ginsberg, Kerouac and so on, and beatnik, which is the thing that comes after it. I mean, beatnik is kind of between the beats and the hippies, if you like. One of the things I would say about that is that the beat culture, the Kerouac, Ginsberg and all the rest of that, initially at least, is very clearly wrapped up in modern jazz. It's much cooler than folk in that sense. There's a very strong sense inside Llewyn Davis that what he inhabits is a predominantly middle-class world. And, of course, it made me reflect back on that folk world that I got to know about in Portsmouth in the 1960s, which I would say was also, to a very large extent, middle class, although it was also populated to a certain extent by people with links to the Navy. And there were certainly people who had been or were still in the Navy who had learned sea songs and sea shanties and so on, who were quite strongly involved in the folk scene in Portsmouth, and they would not be offended by this, they would not have claimed for themselves any kind of coolness in that late 50s, early 60s hip sense. So they were not slimline with Miles Davis suits and all the rest of that, you know. It wasn't that scene at all, but it was quite a literary scene. I think that there were a lot of people on the folk scene who maybe, you know, had decent educations, even if they'd not gone on to higher education. They'd probably done O-levels and A-levels, and they read lots of literature and perhaps smoked black cigarettes and black Russian cigarettes and wore, you know, black polo necks and were a bit kind of existential. But it's a nice reading because there was a certain sense in which some of it lost its coolness. And in Britain, it was kind of odd because there was a very hard-line traditional thing where there were clubs that almost wouldn't have a guitar in the place. you know. Folk singing was about Northumberland pipes or unaccompanied songs about, you know, milkmaids and sailing off around the world.
Yeah.
And there really was that kind of scene, although not in Portsmouth, but certainly in London. There is an odd thing for me about all of this. This film centres on New York and Chicago, so it's predominantly urban locations for what is predominantly a rural genre. And I think there's always been that contradiction.
Okay, we're going to talk about some of the cast and some of the music inside Llewyn Davis. But we're going to have a track now from the soundtrack, which is played by Oscar Isaac, who's the actor who's takes the lead role. And this track is called Green Green Rocky Road. And we'll explain a little bit about that after we've heard it. Green Green Rocky Road. And that's a track that was originally recorded by Dave Von Ronk, and he's the guy who I suppose Inside Llewyn Davis is based on, and based on his book, which is called The Mayor of MacDougall Street, yep. Which is a strange title, and I think was kind of completed posthumously. I think there was another writer who completed the book after his death, I think. So there was a kind of somebody tying up some of the loose ends. Now, we're going to talk about the performances in the film and the soundtrack itself. There is a cast in the film who, I suppose, the names don't spring out instantly at you, but I think they will be known for great things. Certainly their involvement in this film, I think, doesn't hurt their platform, as it were. Oscar Isaac, I mentioned, I think, from the things I've seen, is great. I think he takes on the lead role very well. And I've heard T-Bone Burnett, who's the guy that produced the album, who's done previous cinematics work for Walk the Line and Crazy Heart, those kind of things. I read this great story of him that he was on set timing with a stopwatch, Oscar Isaac actually playing, so that they could, rather than sort of cut and splice and mime and do all those kind of things, they could actually get the tempo and the timing spot on. And the story goes that Oscar was so good that there were no issues with it. So whether that's a PR message, I'm not sure. But there's a lot of music in this film. You know, it kind of goes without saying. I wonder, Dave, how credible is it? How does it come across as kind of being representative of Greenwich Village folk?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all a bit secondhand for me, although, you know, as I say, I do know a bit about it. There was a magazine that was published called Sing Out, which used to actually publish versions of songs, and even across in Britain we'd get hold of it. But it felt, you know, as someone who was kind of getting a version of Greenwich Village folk secondhand 3 or 4 years later, it felt very authentic to me. And I was, even before I was going regularly, I was able to read about it in the Melody Maker, which was a most interesting weekly paper. It was the kind of rival to New Musical Express, but in those days NME was very pop oriented, and Melody Maker did pop, but it also did trad jazz and it did modern jazz and it did folk, lots of folk. So you caught up with all of that. And it struck me as being very authentic indeed. I mean, not least that there were, you know, covers of versions of Van Ronk things that were pretty accurate. But The Last Thing on My Mind by Tom Paxton, which was a song that everybody, it seemed to me, when I started going to folk songs, everybody at folk clubs, everybody sang it and played it, because one of the things was everybody loved singing along with it. My theory about that is that we were a generation that grew up in the 50s in primary schools at a time when folk songs were one of the things you did in primary schools. You sang along to folk clubs, folk songs. They bring these songs to teachers who weren't particularly cool or folky at all, but they were just good songs to sing. And so we were a generation that quite liked. And of course, the other thing, which I noticed no longer happens in the same way, we would go to Sunday school and we would go to morning assemblies at schools. So we would sing collectively every day of the week quite often, apart from Saturday. I might even do that in Saturday morning pictures. So by the time it comes to 61 62, we want to sing different songs, more authentic, what we thought, but we're still quite keen on singing. And so that was one. There's 500 Miles by Hedy West, which is another one that people played all the time. And then there are songs by Ewan McColl, who was the great leader of the British folk movement. There's Shoals of Herring by him, and a Carter Family song, which appears, you know. So I thought T-Bone Burnett is fantastic, you know, and he's done work with Bob Dylan. He's just fabulous. And I thought they got the music. And there's a parody of the Clancy brothers, who come on these wonderful knitted Aaron White sweaters, the four of them. I think the music's great. I think the film's terrific. And the lead actor, you know, Llewyn Davis, he just plays it beautifully.
We should just mention, before we wrap up, The Cat. Most people I've spoken to about this film have said, what was that about the cat? We didn't get that cat. Now, there's an idea, I think, in the film that the cat is loosely a sort of a thread throughout the film, a kind of a narrative in terms of it's something that all of the scenes and all of the elements can hang on. Are you going to just briefly explain about the feline element?
Well, he loses the cat when he just dosses in people's flats until they get fed up and kick him out and he goes somewhere else. So one morning he's leaving the flat. He's got no key. Everybody else has gone. He's leaving this flat that he's been dossing. And as he goes out the door, the cat runs and the door slams. So he can't get the cat back in. The janitor won't take the cat. So he starts walking around New York and traveling on the subway with this cat. And, you know, in a sense, it is a complete metaphor for his life, really, which is that he has this one piece of bad luck. You know, and it is just bad luck. He wasn't particularly careless. He didn't spot it. Cats are like that. They're willful, you know, and so on. And he has this one piece of bad luck and desperately tries to find this cat and return it. Thinks he's found it at one point, but it turns out to be not the right cat. Looks exactly the same, but isn't the right cat. And it's a kind of metaphor. The cat, in the end, the cat is the happy ending bit of the story. I won't spoil the whole story, but the cat's the happy ending and Llewyn Davis isn't really.
Inside Llewyn Davis, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, is out now on general release. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen, and we're having a bit of a folk spectacular. Earlier on this month, I caught up with Mary Epworth at Pie and Vinyl, where she was playing an in-store, an artist herself who touches on the edge of folk. You can catch her current album, Dream Life, but she's off to record new things from February. So I'm with Mary Epworth in the back room of Pie and Vinyl, and just finished playing a set. And I'm really intrigued to ask you about the new album, which is Dream Life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that new. It's been out for a year or so, isn't it? A year and a half.
Yeah, it was. I have to remember which year it was. I think it was June 2012, actually. Yeah.
So it's gaining a bit of momentum, a bit of vintage already, is it?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, we've kind of been putting some singles out that aren't on the album and things, but it's that seems to draw people to it who didn't hear the album first time, so...
So what's the mood of that album? What's the kind of... how would you describe the mood of that album?
It's quite... it's got some quite melancholy things on it, really. And a bit... I mean, I'd say psychedelic, but it's not kind of comedy, sitar, you know, backwards tape psychedelic. It's sort of more...
Is that a route you might go into, do you think?
Yeah,
comedy psychedelic or...?
Oh, no, not comedy psychedelic, okay. But proper psychedelic.
Right, okay.
I'm a massive sort of fan of 60s psych and stuff like that and prog. There's quite a lot of sort of influences on production and things that people probably wouldn't automatically notice, because I think people quite often hear, sort of think female singer-songwriter and sort of have an idea in their head of what I must listen to. But for ages it was nearly called Old Values as a sort of a joke of Iggy Pop's New Values. So it's kind of like influenced by things that you wouldn't necessarily
a kind of response
expect.
To,
yeah.
So your sound, I mean, certainly reading the music press, people struggle... To define your sound.
And yeah.
They usually move around the kind of folk, electro, prog rock brackets.
Right, yeah.
Now that confuses people.
Yeah.
So do you have a kind of tag that you would
I
give
don't.
Your sound?
I'm or? Kind of trying desperately to shake the folk tag, which I think is a thing that is not ever possible to do, because
yeah.
I've made the mistake of kind of describing it as folk rock, but then people just hear the folk bit, and then they kind of... You know, sometimes I've had gigs where people have expected me to turn up with me and acoustic guitar, and it's like big drums and fills and fuzz and things. So.
There is that thing Louis Armstrong said, isn't there, that all music is folk music?
Yeah, right.
Because folk play
folk
it,
play,
you know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. So,
but yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what I would call it. I kind of know what I like, but it's hard to sort of categorise what you're doing. But I am, like my name, quite contrary. So whatever I decide I am, the next thing I write will be... absolutely nothing like it.
Fair enough. Do you think people kind of point the folk finger, if there is such a thing? Because I suppose there are strands of, I suppose, sort of English traditional music in some of the things that you do.
Well, I think that kind of came across because I played the Sandy Denny tribute gig at the South Bank, which was an absolutely amazing experience. But that was sort of like me dipping my toe into folk.
Mm.
And I was, at the time, I was kind of listening to quite a lot of Shirley Collins and that sort of trad folk. But really, that in a way, that's a bit of an aberration, because most of what I'm into is sort of alternative rock of the 60s and 70s. So it's sort of I think that's one bit of what I've been into, but it's not sort of the core thing, really.
I think true folk requires a beard, and
yeah.
as far as I can make out in your band, there's only one beard.
There's only as a very recent beard as well. It was a spectacular moustache until about a month ago.
Nascent folk, maybe. There we are. So tell me a bit about your family. You come from a musical family, don't you? You've got a famous brother, he's a producer.
Yeah.
But also, I think your dad was a bit of an influence on you in terms of things that you heard when you were growing up and
I mean, they're not really musical, actually. Like, it's more like my dad, you know, what he listened to in the car and things was prog and Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel and things like that, and War of the Worlds, which is always terrifying for a small child on a long car journey. But it's a bit weird where the music came from in the family, because there weren't instruments in the house or anything like that. Mm. So it kind of, I think it's a bit of a mutation that it kind of came out.
So you had some strange reference points, I guess.
Yeah,
well, not strange,
I mean,
but, you know, kind of not mainstream.
I think sort of we sort of, Paul and I both sort of educated ourselves musically, and we had a fantastic local venue, so we used to go there a lot, and that's where you met other people who'd be making mixtapes and things. So it was kind of like peer learning, really, more than it being passed down from your family. But yeah, I don't know, my dad loves harmonies, so that's definitely kind of stuck.
Well, who doesn't?
Yeah, and well, idiots.
Well, fair enough. Dream Life, the album, was recorded in some strange places, in some strange circumstance. Mm-hmm. One, I believe, was a barn in Norfolk.
Yep.
And the other is a massage parlour in Berlin. Is that right?
A massage parlour.
I'm I was
doing,
very careful
I'm
to say
doing
that.
Commas
inverted
here.
Commas. Yeah, they're always good on audio, those.
Yeah, well, that's my friend Rainer, whose excellent name. He's called Rainer Süßmilch, which is fantastic.
He sounds like a Welshman.
Technically means it rains sweet milk, apparently, which is another story. But
is that the follow-up title to the album, is it?
Well, he and his brother, between them, play every instrument in a brass band. So once we'd recorded most of the album, Will and I, who produced the album, who plays in the band, we kind of went over to Berlin for a week and just went and with Rainer recorded all his parts, and then he sent them to his brother and he recorded his parts. So we sort of stacked up some of the brass on the album. So,
it sounds that it was kind of unintentional in some ways, the kind of massage parlour element, but
oh no, that was completely
unintentional.
That was his house is above what he thought was a genuine massage parlour for ages. And it turns out it was a certain
ambience type
of massage. Well, we kind of enjoyed the idea of what might be going on downstairs with the sort of trombone above. So
kind
yeah, it was good.
Benny Hill style.
And it was really snowy. I think we went in February and it had been snowing every day since New Year's Eve, and it was like thick, huge snow banks, and the river was completely frozen over, and we walk into the museums in Berlin and there was just this amazing sound of these huge pieces of ice kind of bumping into each other in the middle of the night. It was really, really great experience.
Wow, and your new single is called Snow Queen.
Yep.
Okay, so is that influenced by that period of your life? Or?
Not so much. I do really like snow and winter, and I'd hoped that we'd time it just right. Although I did, my manager sent me a message to say where we're going to be tomorrow. It's going to be snow in the morning. So, yes.
Wow.
Just in time for release date, technically.
So where are you going to be in the morning?
We're filming a video tomorrow, actually. Top secret location.
And I was going to ask you about your videos, because I've looked at some of your videos online and some of the YouTube stuff that you've got. Now, your video, they're quite fun things, aren't they? The video for September.
I think that's the only fun one.
Is it? Well, I don't know. Some of them, I think there's a wry smile in a lot of the stuff you're doing
online. I've had to put a lot of serious, moody faces in my videos. But, No, September was really fun. It was just like a three-hour shoot.
So you're in a kind of cornfield and there's red smoke, is that?
No, that's long gone.
Well,
that's long gone. Yeah, yeah.
So what's September? I've got
September is like we're all dressed up a bit like ABBA or something.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
So that was the quick one. Long gone was a bit guerrilla filming. We kind of did it out in the fields near Stansted Airport, near where I live, and we were letting off smoke grenades. So we were kind of just waiting for the police to arrive. Nothing ever happened. Nobody noticed. So.
I can't remember any planes in the video either. So you must have been quite early morning, or
I think there was like a big backdrop behind me, so you couldn't really see any planes. But I genuinely think that's a bit of a sign of worrying security. If there's people in the field letting off smoke bombs 5 miles from an airport, and nobody comes and checks. You know.
So when you approach a video, do you have you got set ideas that link to the song? Or do you just think, oh, I'm going to have a bit of fun with this, I'm going to do something wacky?
It sort of depends, because we've September, the guy Ben who did that, we're working with him tomorrow, and because ideally we wanted to do a snowy video for Snow Queen, but the snow hasn't come, so we had to sort of spin off and have a slightly different, we've kind of found an angle, which
okay.
I won't reveal until we do it, but it's more about the lyrics of the song than just having some snow and snowmen and things. But I think it depends. Like, we've just worked with different people, and they've come up with great ideas. And the guy who did Long Gone is a brilliant artist called Matthew Robert Hughes, and he did the album cover, did the Dream Life cover. And that's, I keep telling everyone in here today, it's real, that photo. It's not photoshopped. It's me standing with, while somebody blows long falls of powder paint at me.
It reminds
me. So that's a real
me,
analog photo.
It reminds me of a Pink Floyd album cover.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which one it is. I think it might be Saucer Full of Secrets. There's a kind of colourful haze.
Right,
with,
okay,
with you,
yeah,
hiding in the background.
Yeah. That's I'm basically just covered in paint, in a cloud of paint. But it was quite amazing.
It's a very good
it's
effect.
A beautiful
it worked
image.
Very well.
We got that very late in the process of making the album. It was going to have another cover. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a few promos out there with the original cover. So.
They will be worth a fortune.
Yeah, I've got some. I've
hold
got
on,
some.
Hold on to those.
In the eBay stuff.
Fans that are listening, hold on to those. Even tighter. I'm interested in terms of what you're up to next. Are you kind of working on new material and putting things
this
together?
This next week is kind of busy, crazy busy, because we've got this and another install and a radio session and the video. And then February the 1st, everything stops because I want to start writing the next album. So because Will and I in the band run the label as well, and he also is making an album, and we also released another artist in November that's doing really well, called Kieran Leonard. It's been just so much admin. Yeah. I haven't really had time to think about writing. So the idea is that February, at least, I'm writing, he's making his album, and we kind of start.
Get away from the admin, from the tedium.
Yeah, yeah.
The less
no
rock
more,
and roll
no spreadsheets for like at least a month. So that's the plan. And I've kind of I'm writing on different things, because I always wrote on guitar and auto harp before, and I've bought kind of like a little synth setup, and so I'm kind of diving in a bit out of my depth and quite excited about
throwing yourself into new
things. I think it's going to be really interesting to sort of see where that goes. So
well, excellent. Well, we'll await that with great excitement. Yeah. And Mary, thanks very much for talking to me.
A pleasure.
And best of luck for whatever comes next.
And what's coming next is a pie.
A pie. Get
right
yourself
now.
A pie and get the gravy ready as well. Thanks
Thank
very much.
You.
Cheers.
Bye.
We move now to exploring the folk scene from a wider angle, which is always dangerous. Dave and I have grown beards, especially for this recording. But we're going to start by talking about the passing, really, of, I suppose, a character who could be seen by many as the kind of father of folk, or certainly its chief representative for many a year. We're talking about Pete Seeger, who sadly died on the 27th of January this year. And he is, I suppose, known for being a folk singer, an activist, but also a father of a movement, I think. You know, many of the things I read online make reference to not just how he managed to popularise and, I suppose, reinterpret some traditional songs, but also was really entwined with the civil rights movement and various protests and environmental protest. But also, he dabbled with communism and the McCarthy era. So there's a big bundle of things there. Now, Dave and I were talking about Pete Seeger the other day, and we were talking about his music. And his music is a strange mix. And Dave, you were saying that it's not something that instantly hits you.
No, it never has. Although there are some very important songs, you know, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, If I Had a Hammer, We Shall Overcome, he didn't write, of course, but he, in a sense, he found it and reworked it for that white, and it was, one of the things we haven't talked about so far is the extent to which the folk revival in America and Britain in the late 50s, early 60s was a very white phenomenon. Even though there was quite a lot of what we might call folk blues and country blues in it, there were parallel things going on with black blues, acoustic black blues players, but they weren't really wrapped up in the folk revival. And Turn, 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 which again, you know, he takes the lyrics from the Bible, but turns it into a very, very fine song indeed. So what I think about him is that he was a man of extraordinary commitment and integrity, and I admire that enormously. I just don't personally get fired up by his music, which I find oddly almost a little mechanical. So I think he was a man who had great influence on people, but I'm quite happy if other people disagree. One thing I did on my blog, which is not necessarily populated, it's fair to say, by avid folk fans, but certainly a lot of people come on it and make comments about popular music from back then, and I just said, you know, I guess, you know, we're all sorry about the passing of Pete Seeger and so on, but are there any people out there who still listen? And I got one reply, one person who said yes, and he's somebody who listens a great deal to roots music, Bob Dylan and all that kind of stuff. And my suspicion is that when people die, you know, the eulogies pour out, but the truth is that they're not always actually endlessly on the turntable. Some people are, you know. Some people are massive. But in the case of Seeger, I think it's the influence. You know, and people like Billy Bragg are saying he was a big influence, and Springsteen certainly.
Mm. You used a word there, mechanical, which I found really interesting, because one of the things that Seeger is kind of held up for is this kind of, I suppose, rebirth, if you like, of the kind of spiritual song and the spiritual movement. And listening to it, I see what you mean. It's kind of, it's quite basic in parts, and it's quite constructed. But he is someone who, you mentioned We Shall Overcome, didn't write the song, but has become famous for, you know, his version of the song. And
Goodnight Irene is a good example. And in The Weavers, you know, they take this waltz time thing by Leadbelly and they smooth it out. By mechanical, I don't mean in any sense, in terms of the music industry. He's not funky, you know, it's kind of another way in himself, you know, whereas Bob Dylan's funky, is, you know, and Dave Van Ronk is, but Seeger isn't. There is this kind of almost insistent, I'm just making an aesthetic judgment on the beat thing. It's a personal thing. I mean, I think there's another thing that slightly troubled me about one or two of the things that I read in appreciation. But again, I thought it was wonderful that he was getting full pages in newspapers and things, you know. But there was one thing where a guy, I think very romantically, and I think Seeger was a romantic in some sense. He was, you know, he's sort of timeless, but from the past. And this guy says, "And so they die, these poets who propelled the last failed attempt to overcome." Now, it's almost like, well, that's it then. We might as well give up. Nothing's ever going to change, you know. You know, it's a kind of anarchist thing, you know, whoever you vote for, the government gets in. And I don't believe it. I just think, you know, because actually his generation is 30 years older than mine. So he's not just condemning 20-year-olds to a life of, and it's not Pete Seeger who's saying this, it's an appreciation, but I just think it over-sentimentalises it to say, actually, don't bother, guys, there's nothing you can do about it, you know. It don't matter whether it's wars in Syria or floods, you know, because Pete Seeger wouldn't have said that. Pete Seeger would have said, whatever little thing you can do to change the world, do it. And for that, I admire him greatly. And I think we shouldn't sentimentalise and over-eulogise any of these people. I think we shouldn't do that.
He's kind of held as a purist, isn't he? A purist of folk. You were talking earlier on in the programme about, you know, guitars being banned from clubs because, you know, they're the devil's work and they don't kind of fit the sound and all those kind of things. There's the famous Newport Folk Festival incident of 1965 where Dylan wildly goes electric. Now, interestingly, my reading around that is that Seeger perhaps didn't go as mad as is kind of characterised. One of the things I read was that he suggested what he didn't like, what he took umbrage at, was the fact he couldn't hear the words.
That's right.
You know, he could hear the electric sound and he could sense that's where things were moving and where it was going. But Seeger himself didn't object to the kind of the plug going into the guitar. What he objected to was he couldn't hear, and it was the message that was getting lost. And I think that's really interesting. Yeah. There was a big bust-up, by all accounts, at the 65 Folk Festival, which is interesting and... I think quite hard to imagine how the folk crowd kind of turn in on themselves.
Well, it happened in England as well, of course. I mean, there's the famous... There's a book written about it in England, the famous incident in Manchester where somebody calls out... Bob Dylan comes on and plays the first half acoustically in the old style and everybody likes it, and then in the second half comes on with his electric band and somebody shouts Judas, and Bob Dylan says, "I don't believe you." And they find out eventually who this guy was. I think he was by that time living in Canada and has since died, but there's a whole book about it. And funnily enough, I've followed a debate recently among pop music academics about the extent to which the audience at Newport really did heckle Bob Dylan and why they heckled him. And one view that I haven't heard expressed, I mean, you know, the crude view is they heckled him because he went electric, but he was playing with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, who'd actually played earlier in the day and not been heckled at all. So there was no fundamental objection to amplification. So, you know, the question is, what was there? And was there a generation that felt betrayed by Bob Dylan? And did they actually feel betrayed by amplification? Or did they feel betrayed by the fact that he'd already turned his back on Blowing in the Wind and Masters of War and started singing songs about failed love affairs and relationships and personal things? You know, he was already doing that. Or more mysterious songs, you know, so... You know, is Like a Rolling Stone a political song or not? Well, probably not, but Masters of War certainly is. So there are all sorts of objections.
It kind of helps as well, I think, over time to kind of over-embellish that incident, doesn't
That's
it?
Right.
Because, you know, it's then portrayed as a rip, a tear in the
That's
fabric,
right.
a departure point. And maybe it was just, I can't hear what you're saying,
That's
mate,
right.
you know?
People are determined, aren't they, to mythologise, and they're also determined to, you know, to. I think one of the big challenges for anybody who gets involved in history, which I do, is not to look back and demand a pattern of the past that actually wasn't there at the time.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people have just had a bit too much to drink and some bloke starts heckling and somebody else tells them to shut up, and then somebody else thinks, hey, this is fun, let's all boo. I mean, I've stood in football crowds where it's been like that. You don't really feel like booing that guy, but everybody's booing. You think, yeah, this is great. Boo, you know, maybe it was that simple. Yeah, the only other comment I would make that we've already talked about is they're in a field. Okay, so maybe they want their folk music acoustic and they don't like, you know, and plugged in is city music, you know, they might have just felt that. Who knows? Yeah, we'll never know the truth any longer, you know, any more than who killed Kennedy around the same time, you know.
It's a very interesting quote from Pete Seeger I picked up, which was, technology will save us if it doesn't wipe us out first. I really kind of like that. And, you know, obviously he's talking about wider, big atomic things, but, you know, there is something about the music in that as well, in terms of, you know, he's perhaps facing up to the fact that the music that he loves and plays and is committed to is changing. And, you know, how do you respond to that if your kind of traditional base is... In a certain place.
I mean, the question I would ask, if you could go back in time to Newport, and it would be, you know, people sometimes say, if you could time travel, where would you go? That would be a place. That would be kind of amusing. You know, one of my questions would be, at a place like the Newport Folk Festival, I'd say, you don't want amplification. Okay, fine. turn the PA off, and then the front three rows can hear the unaccompanied singers, yeah. And nobody else can. All those other people back there, and it's like, oh no, we've got to have the microphone, got to be able to hear the singer. Well, fine, then plug the guitar in. You know,
absolutely right. And one of the things about Pete Seeger as well is the amount of kind of recorded material he made, the amount of records from 1954 to 2013. Yeah. He pretty much recorded one or two albums a year. So his last album came out last year in 2013, The Storm King, Stories, Narratives and Poems. He was still going, you know, he just couldn't give up. And there was a great, I think, although, you know, you've said how many people are listening or putting it on the turntable, a few. There's a real historic interest in his body of work.
I like that. That's nice if that's happening. I mean, I may be entirely wrong. I'm not sure about it. And I may simply be saying that, you know, as somebody who does listen to some kind of some acoustic and folk musics, that he's not the one that really excites me. It may be just entirely a personal view. I think the other thing that's worth saying in all of this is that he was a very big part of that revival through the 50s, which revolved around particularly what is now, I think, a four album set of by Harry Smith of the roots of American folk music, which had such an enormous impact on people like Jim McGuinn of the Byrds and Bob Dylan, of course, and that whole generation. And it was a generation that kept going through the early 60s. So you had bands like the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, who began as folk acts of one kind or another. Jerry Garcia is playing bluegrass, for instance. Mm-hmm. And gradually, partly through the influence of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and partly because they wanted to be heard more, and partly because they were still young and excited by amplification, they begin to plug in. But they're all... And it links back actually to Mary's music. Mary was talking about the influence of psychedelia, and I wondered quite what she meant by it, given that she's young and it's something that I have a big passion for. But I could hear, you know, in the harmonies, the sound of American psychedelia. You know, this was not the kind of whimsical English psychedelia. It had that American influence, which I thought was super. And of course, it turned around, because the other person she talked about was Sandy Denny, and it turned around with Sandy Denny and one or two other people. Interestingly, quite often women singers in a male rock world. So Maddie Pryor was another one, where you've got the fairly brief British folk rock revival. Fairly brief in a major sense. I mean, it still goes on. People still play what you would call folk rock now. But, you know, Sandy Denny's really interesting to me, because she played, you know, as a fairly unknown folk singer around Portsmouth in the 60s, late 60s. She certainly came down here a couple of times and played concerts and clubs and things, and then turned up at the Guildhall one night. I think the second gig she ever did with Fairport Convention, the great Fairport Convention lineup with Richard Thompson, who did a few folk songs. They did things like A Sailor's Life, which was just stunning. But the interesting thing about Sandy Denny is that actually, as Fairport Convention with Legion Leaf in about 70-71 moved much more into traditional folk music arranged for rock band, she resisted that. She didn't want to do that. She actually wanted to be a contemporary singer-songwriter. She didn't want to be a folk musician. She'd had enough of traditional folk music. And so she left and formed Fotheringay and made solo albums and wrote stunningly beautiful songs, just, you know, including one about Portsmouth, which was rather lovely. The Banks of the Nile, The Sea is another one that she wrote. Just stunningly beautiful. Who knows where the time goes? Just great, great pieces of popular music. So I think those relationships are complicated. So you know, when Mary says people want to call her folk, I think the only people that want to call that folk music are people who think that folk music means an acoustic guitar and probably a woman singing very often. And that isn't really what it means. You
know. Well, let's bring things right up to date to the here and now. Very excitingly, you picked up on your radar a new folk album by a band on the Isle of Wight called the Dolly Mops.
I did.
And when you told me you had the Dolly Mops, I was a little bit worried about where you were going. But they are a traditional kind of, shall we say, pure
Yeah, well, so, yeah. I mean, they might be slightly embarrassed if you went. Although they might not, they might be fine about it. I mean, what they are is a very good example of that other tradition in British folk music, which comes out of the collecting that went on by Victorian and Edwardian collectors, of whom Cecil Sharp is the most famous, and there is now the Cecil Sharp House, and you can go and you know, in fact, Fairport Convention, when they were doing things like A Sailor's Life and Legion Leaf, they were going to Cecil Sharp House and finding these things, then rearranging them for rock bands. What the Dolly Mops, who are Isle of Wight based, what they do is go and find those songs, and they don't do anything of the sort. There's a guitar, on acoustic guitar on some tracks, but it's essentially very much three-part harmony, traditional English songs, and wherever possible in this region. I mean, I picked it up because one of the Dolly Mops, Justin Smith, is a very good mate of mine. We worked together at university, and he teaches film there. But and then there's a couple as well, Dorana Philpott and Virgil Philpott, who also sing. But I mean,
they've got perfect folk names, haven't they?
Yes, it's yes, brilliant. But there are songs on it like On Gosport Beach, The Isle of Wight, The Loyal Isle of Wight Volunteers, and the kind of titles you'd expect from these traditional folkies, like British Man of War, Jolly Harvestman, All Jolly Fellows, The Base Bosun's Story. You know, this is very much the rural and seafaring history, you know, and they are songs from the 17th, 18th, 19th century that they've gone and found in places. And it's their second album. They do performances here and there. And as I was saying earlier, you know, they're a bit like my country blues band. They're guys who have other jobs and can do this with a passion and a caring without having to in any sense go through the machinery of the industry. You know, I don't know if they were on X Factor or The Voice, I'm not sure they'd get very far, you know, which is a compliment to
there's
them.
Only one way to find out, I think. We will put links to some of the Dolly Mops work so you can have a listen for yourself on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. and just before we go, we've got time to check out a couple of local events that you might want to go and see. Dave, you've got two. I think one is an arty one.
One is an arty one. It's my you know, my usual favourite, which is the Palant Gallery. But I'm going to give a shout, first of all, on the 1st of March, Saturday the 1st of March, at the Dockyard Club, Onslow Road, Southsea. It's the monthly session for the Dock Soul Club, where I go dancing. And it's all kind of 60s soul and northern soul stuff, all night long. Brilliant dancers, fabulous fun. Went last Saturday, and 1st of March is the next one.
Has to be seen.
I just love it. And then a little more relaxed at the Palant Gallery. By the time you hear this, it will have started. 15th of February to the 15th of June. Stanley Spencer, mid 20th century, Heaven in a Hell of War. It's a very particular movement of a whole cycle of work that is normally shown at the Sandham Memorial Chapel in Burghclere, Hampshire. And it's about his experiences of the First World War. And that particular chapel is being renovated. It's all being moved to the Palant Gallery in Chichester, with a couple of other new shows. One is about artist studies. It's the pencil studies for later paintings. That too runs right through till the middle of June. And Dennis Creffield, who's made these remarkable big charcoal drawings of the cathedrals of England and France. So loads of new stuff to see at the Palant Gallery, and it looks very, very exciting indeed.
Well, excellent. Dave, as ever, thank you, and thank you for helping me find my way through the fog of folk.
You're welcome.
Our thanks also to Pie and Vinyl for helping out with the Mary Epworth set. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.